This podcast is part of the Paris FinTech Forum Communities Programme and is brought to you with the support of BPI France. You're listening to the FinTech Podcast, the show that goes deep into the stories, the successes and failures that went into creating some of the world's most fantastic fintechs. I'm Elliot Gotkin, and in this episode, how Nicholas Merrick made the leap from particle physics to fintech and the challenges he faced along the way with DreamQuark.
When you are in the position where you see cash diminishing really significantly and you don't really know whether you will make it, I had that moment, for example, in 2016. It's really stressful moment because you say, what will you do next?
Nicholas Merrick, founder and CEO of DreamQuark, thanks so much for joining me on the FinTech Podcast.
Thank you very much, Elliot. It's really a pleasure.
Yes, nice to see you again. So look, I'm a bank or a fintech. I've heard using AI, artificial intelligence, is good for customers and it's good for profits. So I come to you, I come to DreamQuark, and I say, what can you do for me?
So basically what we do for you is, if you are a wealth manager, we can provide to your relationship managers, to independent advisor, a platform that enables them to identify the next opportunities or the alerts regarding their customers. And these opportunities and alerts are generated by AI. And by that, we mean that we can identify what are the next sales opportunity, for example, that your relationship manager may have. And besides that, we have a platform which enable banks, insurance companies, maybe also companies outside financial services, that enable them to create AI and create an AI that is explainable. That means that every time the artificial intelligence has learned some pattern, it is capable to explain these patterns.
And to integrate DreamQuark software, I think, is it called Brain, your main product, to integrate that with their systems, they need someone, they just download it from, you know, like a SaaS kind of service, you have to come in, is it kind of drag and drop? How does it work?
Yes, exactly. So this platform Brain can be provided as a software as a service. Unfortunately, right now, a lot of financial services firms are not yet completely into a software as a service. So they prefer to have it deployed on premises. So we can deploy it either in their like facilities or on their private cloud. So it supports AWS, it supports Azure, GCP, but also IBM Cloud. And we have also the project to deploy them on mainframe. So we really want our software to be deployed wherever our customer wants it to be deployed.
But if I'm a big bank or a fintech worth a few billion, as they all seem to be these days, presumably I can just hire a bunch of data scientists who will build something for me that, you know, similar, that does the same thing as you do? Or is there some kind of edge that you would provide that they wouldn't be able to get if they built on their own?
So obviously we have some edge. I don't think that a fintech can exist without an edge. So I would say that we have two main edge. The first is we are vertical. So we target mainly the waste management industry, and we can go from the data to the relationship managers. And that's a really unique proposition to be able to provide relationship managers these calls that are explained and all the process from the data towards the advisor portal. That's one of the value proposition. But also on top of that, in particular within Brain, what we target since the beginning are citizen data scientists. So there are many data scientists that have been hired across financial services institution. But now companies that want to scale understand that they need to address other type of profile that have some background in statistics, that really know the business, but are lacking the complete expertise to be able to develop by themselves the algorithm. So they need to have new tools. And by providing them a really intuitive interface, a process that is more automated, and also new functionalities around AI governance, responsible AI, which are the next wave of features that banks are looking for. We really are able to scale their initiatives. So that's the two type of approach. First is vertical end-to-end, and the other is being able to address other type of profile that could not be addressed with tools that exist right now on the market.
Okay. Now, I mean, I'm looking forward to the day when I don't have a question about the pandemic or anything that's COVID-related, but unfortunately, we're still not out of it just yet. Now, when the pandemic did strike, or when it started becoming clear that this was a major thing that was globally impactful, did you think, as the CEO and founder of DreamCorp, did you think, yikes, you know, what are we going to do now? What actually went through your brain when that realization dawned?
So it went through my brain, not the platform first, but with the team, we took care of our people, and we just a couple of months earlier had raised a major round. So that was an opportunity to not put, like many firms, our companies on hold, but really to think about what we need to do next. We understood quite early that the behavior of our customer would shift because the urgency was different. And basically, when you are in the midst of a crisis, you need to, like innovation is perceived differently. So up to now, we were really providing a AI platform, and we understood that providing AI platform may not be the best thing. So we needed to go develop new functionalities on top of that to really serve really specific needs that our customer were having. So really quickly, it started, I was in holidays at that moment, we were starting an initiative with Atos around sustainable banking. In particular, we identified that people were realizing the need to accelerate their sustainable transition, and that sustainable banking would really accelerate, which is what we see right now. Major strategies are released with sustainable banking at the Earth. So we developed around our platform new functionalities to be able to assess the carbon emissions of this product, to be able to build a complete portfolio with this emission in mind, but also other criteria. So that was the start of our journey. And then we went even bolder. We decided to put the AI platform on hold somehow, but to focus more on the end users, which were shifting from data scientists to relationship managers. So it has been a major pivot for DreamQuark, and we see the benefit now because we have clarified our value proposition. We have completely transformed the company around the proposition of what we do with AI is we help relationship managers better navigate this new reality, being able to understand what are the needs of their own customers that are highlighted by AI, identify what are the investment propositions they need to make to their customers in order to drive AUM. And we have something really clear for them, really simple to use, which is powered by AI. And that has been a complete change for the company.
But as a business, did you see everything suddenly come to a standstill, that, you know, no one wanted to meet or sign up to your services or something? Were you maybe a little bit concerned?
So we have been concerned, but over the past 7 years, we have had to many different positions which were uncomfortable. So we have the mindset to react. So we made our solution free during the pandemic, so that new companies could access our technologies for free. That enabled us to get access to new feedbacks that we were not having, because we were targeting sponsors. We shifted towards users in our go-to-market. And we had, through that, many firms that signed up to our offering. So that was the first thing. But we continue to have conversation, not the same kind of conversation, because decision process were on hold for most of them. But some companies were willing to start to identify what type of proposition they could develop, what type of other things they could do during that pandemic, because suddenly many people were having time. They were rushing for some on the urgency, deploying, working from home, deploying teams and so on. But at the same time, other people were not having a really busy agenda, and it was time for them to understand a new value proposition. So our team has been really busy for that period, but productively busy, I would say.
But net, was it good for business? Did it help boost revenues in the way that many fintechs have said, you know, engagement or revenues went up fivefold or sixfold or something? Did you see some kind of massive boost to you from the pandemic?
So we have had growth, but we have a B2B approach, which is different from a B2C approach. So B2C, indeed, people were trying to have new tools. So B2C has been really positively impacted. B2B is a bit delayed. So now we are seeing this boost because companies have started to understand that the behavior of the customer were shifting. So now they have shifted for some really significantly, and they need solution to now provide this new value proposition to the customers. And the fact that we shifted also during the pandemic to adapt and serve these customers, our customer differently, we see now that we have an increase in leads, and progressively these leads that are becoming customers. So that we have a 1 year delay compared to the ones that have been directly impacted during the COVID confinement across the world.
Okay, and you said you just raised a round just before lockdowns started in earnest. Where are you now in terms of fundraising?
So we raised in total $20 million since the beginning. So the idea is that we are now not raising. We've changed that value proposition. Now we are focusing on metrics. The idea is to focus on that later next year, but being really, really focused on business now.
Right, because I was going to say, you know, there are some AI companies out there, like Data Robot, for example, which are raising hundreds of millions of dollars at, you know, multi-billion dollar valuation. So in the grand scheme of things, $20 million would seem, with the greatest of respect, relatively small amount. Yep. So at some point, should we expect to see DreamQuark joining the ranks of these kind of monster rounds?
That, obviously, that's what we aim for. But since we shifted, we were really focused on providing a really clear value proposition rather than just looking for rounds and rounds. That's why next year we will be much more ready than we are right now. Right now we are chasing, as I said, metrics. We are solving the pain point of our customers. We are delivering that new value proposition on the market, and I feel that now my focus needs to be this, and because if I spend my time looking for fund in the midst of a complete transformation, that's difficult. You need to help navigate to help your team navigate that transformation. So my time is better spent with my team now than looking for and customers, rather than looking for new funds. So I've also recruited new people, so that people that we need to onboard, and once all that will be fixed with execution that is not needing myself, I will be focusing on the fundraising to be able to accelerate much faster on the next phase.
One thing that doesn't seem to be changing is your name. I'm always fascinated about where names of companies come from, especially if they appear a little bit random to perhaps the uninitiated. Where does the name DreamQuark come from?
So before creating DreamQuark, I was working on the particle physics. And the quark is a tiny particle that makes up most of the matter across the universe. I've been focusing my PhD thesis on these quarks. So I wanted to have a reference to what I did during the PhD that led to the creation of DreamQuark. And every quark has a name. So there is a strange quark, there is a beauty quark. And I was thinking that we want to make our customer dream. And therefore, rather than being strange or beautiful, we would make them dream. So that's why we put the dream in front of it.
I'm so glad we get to talk about physics, something that I stopped studying as soon as I was allowed to drop it at school. As you say, you did a PhD, and I was reading the summary. We're saying you studied the computation of perturbative corrections to a physical process, mostly seen at LHC in the high energy regime, which didn't mean a huge amount to me. But now you've explained to us a little bit more. But what was the connection between this kind of physics focused PhD and what you're doing now?
So when you're working at an experiment like the one that you have at LHC, it's not like a physics experiment that you can get in a lab at school.
This is the Large Hadron Collider,
exactly.
Right?
So actually you have many detectors which are made of multiple smaller detectors. So you can have hundreds of thousands of these detectors. So each of them produces a signal. And what you have at the end is really large files that you need to analyze. And what really key is that you have a collision every 25 nanoseconds. So that means that in a minute, you have tons of these collisions. And you can't analyze that with just your eyes. So what you do is you're applying computer science to identify some signals. You are using a lot of statistics. And over time, people started to use machine learning because it's really hard to identify some signals within these billions of different collisions that are happening every year at LHC. At an experiment like ATLAS, which is the one I was working on, it generates per year more data than at Google, at Facebook, at Amazon, United. So you need to develop new tools to be able to analyze that. And I was working at that moment already on deep learning. And basically, when I started the company, I continued to work on deep learning, but for other applications. So that is the connection between the DreamQuark and my PhD at CERN.
And how did you actually make the leap from this PhD, from academia, to setting up a fintech-focused AI software company? Was it an easy leap? Was it easy to, I don't know, persuade investors to come up with the idea and do everything that a founder needs to do when setting up a startup?
So it has not been completely difficult. I started to work on the project directly after I submitted my PhD. I defended it in September, and by the end of September, I was working on creating that company. It took 6 months to create the company, to think about the project. Obviously, the DreamQuark of 2021 is very different from the DreamQuark in 2014. I met my first business angel really early in 2014. I had my first customer in 2014 as well. So it has been a big change, becoming a salesperson when you are a developer or a physicist is really a big shift. In 2015, I had the first round of BAs, and 2017, the first VCs came in, 2 years after a new round. But I would say that for a European company, obviously it's much more difficult than for US companies, which are more used to finance people coming from university with PhDs. So it was not really easy when I started, in particular in AI. And over the past 7 years or so, I saw that several companies in AI that has been created have since disappeared. and probably in massive proportion compared to what you have in the US. So it's really different, but now what I see and I'm really pleased about that is that Europe has becoming a really booming place for creating companies. It's much more easier now to create a company. It's much more easier to get funded. And I see that investors have identified that you may have really bright people in universities or in other type of parcours that have things to do. You have, for example, if you want to go in quantum computing, obviously you will look for someone who has experience in quantum computing. So these guys have done PhDs. So that's the type of thing you can see. So depending on the sector, depending on what you want to fund, obviously you will look for PhDs. Sometimes you will look for people who have no PhD because it doesn't make sense to have a PhD. So my to make it short now, it was not so complicated, but you needed perseverance. And I think that things that changed to really enable the growth of European player. And at some point, Europe will become like in the US.
And people got it. Investors weren't slamming the door in your face or laughing you out the room or something. It was a relatively easy sell at the time.
No, because I probably did not know how to sell a company. I learned a lot about that. Communication is not the first thing you learn when you're doing a PhD when you are at university. So you need to learn that, to learn about marketing, product marketing, building a product. I did it probably really wrong, but I've learned on how to make it right. You think on the technology first, but when you have some experience, you think about market needs and user needs first. So you need to rewire your brain. So over the past 7 years, I think I completely rewired my brain. Probably if I was doing a new company now, I would do it really differently. That's what it feels when you transform the company like we did since a year now. You do it completely differently, and that requires humility because you're changing. You need to learn different way. You need to listen differently from people. I think I would love to be 7 years from to have been 7 years from now the entrepreneur I became.
I guess everything's a learning experience. And your family, did you come from a long line of PhDs and academics or entrepreneurs?
I don't really have a family of entrepreneurs. My father is a professor. So I think I have this gene of learning and somehow teaching as well. And that's why I went to this type of studies. My father was also doing some physics, so that's why I continue to be in physics. Creating a company is somehow quite new for our family.
Okay, well, maybe there'll be more Merrick entrepreneurs from henceforth in the future. But look, we're going to come back to Nicolas's story in just a moment, but I just need to remind everyone listening that this podcast is part of the Paris FinTech Forum Communities Program for 2021. And in this special pandemic period, you can enjoy throughout the year top-level live sessions with key industry players, exclusive on-demand interviews such as this one, and use our innovative digital networking capabilities to meet your peers, develop your network, create new business opportunities, and continue to build together the future of the fin and tech industry. And you can find out more at www.parisfintechforum.com. So, Nicolas, you've raised your first round, you've got your product, you've got customers, you're off to the races. How's it been? I mean, you've talked about a little about the transformation and about having to pivot, but as a CEO, as a founder, has it been an incredibly stressful ride? Has it been lots of ups and downs, moments when perhaps you thought this just isn't going to work and think about packing the whole thing in? How has it been for you?
I think, yeah, creating a company is a roller coaster, but you have bright people on your side. So I've been always with really good people that became friends as well. So, and it's important in a difficult moment to have these people. So it's not like even if I have been a solo founder, you always need to be with the brightest people that can help you, and in particular help you in the difficult moment. So obviously there have been a difficult moment because at some point you think about will you have the cash to continue? Is your idea making sense? And so on, so forth. You need to pivot.
What was the most difficult moment for you?
Oh, I have had a couple of ones that could be as difficult, I would say. When you are in the position where you see cash diminishing really significantly, and you don't really know whether you will make it. I had that moment, for example, in 2016. It's really stressful moment because you say, what will you do next? And you're really tight as an entrepreneur. And I think that my main quality is that I never stop. And I think about different ways to do that, how to adapt. And so far, so good. It worked, but it worked also because I had the right person with me. And also I had business angels, and now I have investors that know that when you build a company, it's more likely that you will have bad moments than good moments. And they know how to support you in these times where you need to take a tough decision, for example. So that's something you learn, and you need to learn fast, I would say.
You also, on your company's website and as a company, you talk a lot about the kind of ethical side of AI, I think. And can you just perhaps explain that a little bit more, that the requirement for, is this things like removing gender or ethnic biases from algorithms, things like that?
Ethical AI, there are many pillars behind that. Obviously, it comes to mind that you need to reduce discrimination. That's really important, but that's not the only thing that is important when you do ethical AI. You have also pillars where we are quite strong since 2016, which is explainability. Your users need to understand how the models you built and they are using are taking decisions. That's a key element of trust, to be seeing that the model is using the right information for creating this prediction. You need also to make sure that the model is robust. So there are an entire industry that is getting built at the moment, which is called MLOps, where companies are taking data, they create models, they deploy models, and then they monitor these AI models to make sure that the performance and the behavior is consistent. And if data is changing too much, you need to retrain the algorithm you've been using and redeploy them. So that's a key element of also ethical AI. You have also the impact that it may have on people. So it's not just about discrimination, but for example, if you create an algorithm that spoils the planet, and now we see that the algorithms that are getting built are generating a lot of carbon emission, you need also to understand how to control this carbon emission. And finally, this is also the type of application you are using, you're deploying using this artificial intelligence. So if you are ethical, you can prevent yourself to use AI for doing some type of activities. And that becoming quite important now, ethical AI, because there are regulations that are emerging. On the 21st of April, a new regulation has been presented by the European Commission. And across the world, regulators are investigating more deeply the use of AI. And now some applications start to be forbidden. So for example, in Europe, if you want to do social scoring, if you want to use AI for biometric analysis or so on, either completely forbidden or controlled. because there are some risks associated to that.
And people also often talk about augmented AI, making humans better or more efficient at doing their jobs rather than by actually replacing them. Is that something that's realistic over the long term?
I don't know if AI can replace human. I would say that right now AI is quite dumb. It looks smart, but without human behind it, we are really far to have this type of AI that take over of people. So on some activities like playing Go, playing poker, AI is much more performing. But that's not necessarily because it's smarter. It's just that it can handle much more information that a human can do. And it's fully efficient at analyzing the different opportunities. I think intelligence is much more broader than that. You have new algorithms that are emerging, like GPT-3, for example, which is a new generation of algorithm for generating speech. It may have really smart sentences that are generated for text that looks really compelling. But at the same time, people hide all the junk that is generated by this type of algorithm. So that's also something that some people say. If you have like 100 monkeys that invest in stock, you may have one monkey that looks the smartest in the room. But that just that is statistics. So right now we are really far, but that's interesting to ask ourselves the question of how that technology can get out of control. A lot of technology went out of control in the past, so it's good to have this question. But we are really far, from my point of view, of having an AI that rule us all. So don't be scared too much about that. Don't be scared. AI is in control.
Well, that's a relief. There's nothing, no Terminators coming to get us over the horizon. But I'm curious to know, vis-a-vis financial services and fintechs, where AI you think will be in 5-10 years time. I mean, we've already got, now let's take Lemonade, for example, using AI chatbots to kind of process claims for the most part, for example. It's used in many other aspects to make things more efficient, to help boost profitability, to save time, to save money. So where do you see AI in financial services and in fintech going over the next, I don't know, 5-10 years?
I will say that the other technology, it's disruptive trend. So people now are doing are taking the low-hanging fruit, where a lot of companies are still experimenting with AI. And over the next 2 to 5 years, they will actually deploy much broader this technology. I see that many applications where AI is failing right now, AI will actually become successful. So obviously, behind many sales, you will have many salesperson. You will have AI powered assistant. I think that type of use case is really taking over. You will have compliance, which will be entirely done with AI. So now it's most of the time rule based system, and this rule based system will be progressively replaced by machine learning algorithm. Quite think that chatbot will become smarter, because right now when you have you are in front of a chatbot, most of the time that just text, you have a decision tree, and depending on what you put, you have one answer. But if you do something which is really different, probably you won't get the right answer. So with this new type of GPT-3 type of algorithm, we will be able to follow much complex decision without having to build a complete tree behind. So it will be much more agile. I think that the type of application we will see emerging and being scaled across financial services. I don't really see that we will have like a bank entirely ruled by AI. It will be a specific application. And obviously, what we will see is that by 2023, that new regulation will come into force. So that means that new tools will be also developed for supervision by the regulator, like algorithmic audit will become an emerging use case and a use case that a company will want to investigate. So that's the type of change I oversee. And besides that, I wrote recently an article on the new algorithm and how they can be adopted. There are new type of structures that are right now not really used, but will really become massively adopted, like knowledge graph. So everything around the graph analytics will become significant. And probably algorithm may adapt to changing condition much better, thanks to taking into account causality. So right now, basically, when you have an algorithm, COVID comes, the algorithm is not able to navigate this changing reality. And because now companies are aware about that, they are looking for ways to change that paradigm. And integrating causality in algorithm will be key for that. So if you have a behavior that is changing, the algorithm will be able to much more react. So that's the type of change I oversee over the 5 to 10 years, but probably not something drastically changing.
And perhaps robo-advising, since you mentioned the wealth management space a few times, perhaps robo-advising will take off in that time as well?
I was speaking about AI-powered sales assistant. So that's for relationship manager, but that's really easy to make it for people. And wealth manager at the moment are really focusing on the providing tools to the relationship manager, because they would still want to have this mixed digital versus human approach, but they are focusing a lot on the end users. Obviously, with a solution like Robinhood, you have a really solid solution that millennials want to adopt, and being able to target these millennials with the right tool will be key for wealth managers or traditional banks to not lose their market shares. So I think it's really important to focus efforts on that target, because over the next 10 years, a massive wealth transfer will happen. And the millennials that are young, not a lot of wealth, massive debts, may become the new wealthy. So you don't want to miss that as a bank.
And I guess so long those robo-advisors will have to ensure that they're smarter than our smart monkey who's done so well in the stock market. But look, Nicholas, this is a question I put to everyone at the end of the FinTech podcast. And I know I haven't primed you, so hopefully we'll get a good answer the first thing that comes into your brain. What is the weirdest or craziest thing you've ever built or done in your life? And Dream Quark cannot be your answer.
Maybe it's not the craziest thing, but it looks as the craziest thing for my girlfriend when I ate fugu. Which is this fish that may kill you if it's not well prepared. So I did some other crazy thing, but that's probably for a lot of people one of the craziest thing you can do.
Wow, eating fugu. Presumably it didn't poison you, so you had the right chef. was it tasty?
Yeah, it's quite good. It was the cook was a great cook, so it was tasty.
Oh, lovely. I remember there's an episode of The Simpsons where Homer eats some and he thinks that he's eaten the wrong bit and he's going to die, but in the end he doesn't. So all is well, and happy to see you full of life as well after eating your fugu. So Nicholas, we're kind of out of time, but I really want to thank you, Nicholas Merrick, founder and CEO of Dream Quark. Thank you so much for joining me on the FinTech podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Elliot, for this time.
Thank you. Take care. Running a successful fintech can sometimes be about trade-offs. Do you raise money now when VCs are shoveling cash their way? Or use your precious time to focus your efforts on transforming the business for a possible payoff later? Nicholas Merrick has chosen the latter, and although there may be no such thing as a dream quark in physics, there's every chance there'll still be one in fintech for some time to come. So thank you, Nicholas Merrick, and thank you for listening to the FinTech podcast with me, Elliot Gotkin, now part of the Paris FinTech Forum Communities Program. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and you can get updates and listen to all previous episodes via the website, www.parisfintechforum.com. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can find us on LinkedIn and on Twitter at Paris Fin Forum or at Elliot Gotkin. That's it from me. Thanks again to BPI France for sponsoring this podcast. We'll be back again next week for more of the best FinTech. Hope you'll join us again then. Bye-bye.